Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin with Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture. We've had a lot of podcasts recently with Darwin skeptics who are signers of our Descent from Darwinism list. And today we have another signer of the Descent from Darwinism list, Dr. Rebecca Keller, who has a PhD in biophysical chemistry from the University of New Mexico and did research at UC Berkeley and the Department of Neuroscience and the Department of Cell Biology at the University of New Mexico. Dr. Keller actually started to take a new career direction in 2001 when she became a textbook author writing textbooks called Real Science for Kids, and she's now the CEO of Gravitas Publications, which publishes Real Science for Kids. So, Dr. Keller, thank you very much for being on our show with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd first like to ask you a little bit about your scientific background. Having a PhD in biophysical chemistry sounds very impressive, and it sounds like someone who couldn't decide whether they like biology, physics, or chemistry more, and so they just combine them all into one field. So maybe could you explain to us, is that the case with you? And if so, what is exactly biophysical chemistry?
That's about right. I couldn't decide what I liked better, biology, physics, or chemistry. The degree I got was in the chemistry department, and I worked for an advisor who was using the scanning Cumming microscope to visualize, at the time, biological molecules. So we were really using physics to study biology in the chemistry department, and his background was in biophysical chemistry, and that was the lab that I joined.
Okay, and did you always want to be a biophysical chemist, or did this just kind of happen?
No, actually, my intent when I started graduate school was to become an oceanographer. I come from the desert, and so I have a passion for water, if you will, and I think I miss having a lot of water, and I really was interested in becoming an oceanographer. I got my undergraduate degree in chemistry at New Mexico Tech, which my father said was the best place in New Mexico to get a science degree. After finishing at New Mexico Tech, I went to Sweden and worked out there for a year at a nuclear research facility. And when I came back to the States, I pursued a degree in oceanography at the Florida Institute of Technology. But I only lasted about 4 weeks because I get horribly seasick. So I came back to New Mexico, actually, and joined the chemistry department here in Albuquerque at UNM.
Okay, well, I guess oceanographers need to be able to love the ocean and need to be able to be around the ocean a lot.
Yes, I love the ocean, but I apparently can't stand too long to be on a boat.
Wow. Well, you
definitely... Part of the ocean, you have to be on a boat. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well, I have to say, you probably missed out. I did most of my graduate coursework at Scripps Institution for Oceanography, and I'll tell you, the students there have it pretty good. Being next to the ocean for a number of years while you're studying, you know, you have your professors who come in dripping wet into the classroom because they were just surfing, and it's, a lot of work gets done, but it is a lot of fun as well.
I wanted to live on the beach, but I never got to do that.
Well, it sounds like you were just meant to stay in the desert, I guess. So,
yes. I'm a native of New Mexico, and I've been here my whole life, and I like the desert. The desert is nice.
It is very beautiful in the Southwest. And you then went back to the University of New Mexico, and you worked in the departments of neuroscience and cell biology there doing research. Maybe could you tell us a little bit about the research you were doing in those positions?
Yes, when I was in the cell biology department, I was working on mRNA processing protein called PAB2 polybinding protein. And when I went to the neuroscience department, I was still working on mRNA processing proteins, a protein called HUD. What I was looking at was the length of RNA transcripts with or without these processing proteins.
And so was this, again, using biology, physics, and chemistry combined, or was this more of a strictly biochemistry type of research project?
Yeah. Well, in the cell biology department, what we were looking at was I was actually learning how to use or being trained to use the electron microscope to visualize these particles that the poly-A binding protein would form on poly-A tails. And so it was still kind of biophysics in the sense that we were looking at biology and we were using some physical techniques to observe them. When I did my stint in the neuroscience department, it was mostly molecular biology. I really wanted to get a better grasp of both the molecular biology tools and the science itself.
Now, when you were doing these research projects, I would imagine that you had a lot of exposure to molecular machines and the biological machines, what I mean, not human machines, but biological molecular machines. Was that the case?
Yes. One of the very first things I worked on as a graduate student was RNA polymerase, which is a type of molecular machine. And I was really fascinated by the whole area of molecular machines. I mean, this was really a fascinating topic to me, how these proteins function as little tiny machines inside cells.
I think this makes a good segue into talking about your views on biological evolution. Now, I understand that you, as I mentioned earlier, are a signer of our Descent from Darwinism list. And you also have been an outspoken proponent of teaching students about the scientific strengths and weaknesses of Darwinian evolution. So could you tell us a little bit about how you became a scientific skeptic of evolution and what was some of the evidence that really made you start to question Darwinism?
During my undergraduate career, I mainly studied chemistry, and I was a believer in the Darwinian view of how life got started because that was the only thing I was taught. When I got to graduate school and I began working on transcription machinery, it really kind of started to settle in of, you know, how do these molecular machines and this really sophisticated network of machines function, and how did they get there? And there was just a lot of gaps in the Darwinian explanation for how a molecular machine would have been produced via random chance and mutation. And so there were these significant gaps from what I was observing in the laboratory and what I was learning, you know, in the molecular biology field between this molecular machinery and how it got there.
Did you see that there were Darwinian explanations for these molecular machines?
No, actually, that was the big gap, is that nobody could tell me what a Darwinian mechanism would be for these machines. There was no explanation for how you could get the components of these sophisticated systems to work together.
Sure.
And that was one of the issues that I started to question, and there wasn't an explanation. There is no good mechanism still for how you get this kind of sophisticated machinery inside a cell.
Now, of course, Dr. Keller, you're aware of the objection from the Darwinian community that we often hear, which is that you just haven't given them enough time. If you give them enough time, they're going to come up with the explanation and that you are guilty of, you know, maybe doing something like a God of the Gaps type of argument. You're just not letting them figure out how evolution works. How would you respond to those kind of objections?
Well, until they show me the data, it's really an evolution in the gaps explanation. In other words, there isn't any solid evidence for how you get it from the chemical precursors to a molecular machine. And until they show me, a viable mechanism and the data, it's really just a faith-based response to say evolution did it without any evidence.
So what you're really saying is you don't have enough faith to believe in an evolutionary explanation for the origin of these structures.
No, I don't. I don't have enough faith in the evolutionary explanation. I mean, it's possible that at some point science will elucidate how through, you know, random chance and mutation or the standard Darwinian mechanism, how these molecular machines come about. But until they do, I don't want to believe something because somebody tells me I have to. I want to see the data.
Well, you heard it here first on the ID of the Future podcast. Don't inject faith into science is what you're telling us, Dr. Keller. I would also like to ask you a question that I enjoy asking many of the scientists we've had on the show, and that is, obviously, you worked in the mainstream research world, and you worked in academia for a number of years. You're aware of how people are treated when they stand up and question Darwinism. And I was wondering if you could share with our listeners, have you experienced or have you at least been aware of examples and instances of people being persecuted or at least just marginalized because of their views that they are skeptics of Darwinian evolution or proponents of intelligent design?
Well, it was interesting, you know, after I signed the Darwin Dissent list, there was somebody who contacted a colleague of mine in hopes of exposing that I was an ID proponent. And this was a colleague of mine whose grant I was working on. And he actually came to me and said, you know, don't get involved in this. Don't be involved in this kind of stuff. And, of course, he wasn't a boss, so I was able to continue working. But the climate was very clearly, don't be involved in these kinds of issues.
Hmm. And let's say that one of your colleagues had gone and written a letter to a state board of education supporting the teaching of the pro-Darwin only viewpoint, or let's say that they became a board member of the National Center for Science Education, or got involved with some kind of a public petition supporting evolution and condemning intelligent design. Do you think that they would have received this kind of treatment?
No, not at all.
Wow.
Not at all. There's clearly a lot of hostility within the scientific community for any dissent of the Darwinian theory. And yet it's the very tension that dissent creates that is healthy for science. It's really good for the theory of evolution itself to have one common challenge and say, hey, look, there's these gaps. How are you going to answer these questions? It's really a healthy thing for science itself to have challenges and to have dissent.
Yes, yes.
It moves the process of science forward.
That's very true. And I think that what I have seen, actually, I was just writing something this morning, looking at how the challenge of intelligent design has really caused scientists to go back and try to start thinking about evolutionary explanations for the origin of these molecular machines. Some days, I'm not even sure if they would really be interested in that topic if the issue hadn't been raised by intelligent design. I mean, what do you think about that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the whole history of science, science is full of contention and dissent and controversy and heated arguments about what is. And if you don't have those arguments and if you don't allow that dissent, that's what stops science.
Sure, sure.
Intelligent design and the challenges to the Darwinian paradigm is really healthy for science overall and for Darwinism and for evolution, because that's how the process of science works. The history of science really speaks to this.
That is very well put. And Dr. Keller, we're going to talk more in the next podcast about your textbook authorship of the Real Science for Kids textbook series, which implements this philosophy and helps to train students how to think critically and how to actually ask questions that a scientist would ask and how to think like a scientist. And I think that it's really important people realize that these are not just esoteric, abstract ideas that you're talking about right now. What you're talking about is a philosophy of doing science and educating students about science that helps them to become good scientists. I mean, I'm sure you would agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm hoping with the curriculum that I'm developing, it will allow an openness for discussing different interpretive frameworks. And all of these different ideas that everyone brings to the table is really, you know, what pushes new scientific discoveries forward.
Yes. Well, let's just close this out by talking briefly about your standing up in favor of objective science education on the topic of evolution. I know that about a little over a year ago, you went and actually testified before the South Carolina State Board of Education in favor of an indicator that would actually require critical analysis of evolution. And in the end, that indicator was adopted by the state board and the state legislature there so that South Carolina now requires students to critically analyze evolution. Maybe you've already gone through this, but tell us a little about what you said there when you were testifying, why it's important for students to critically analyze evolution.
Well, I mean, the basic issue that was discussed over there in South Carolina was just the simple wording of critically analyzing. Is it okay if students critically analyze scientific data? And the answer is absolutely, because unless a student is taught how to critically analyze scientific data, and not just Darwinian evolution, but all scientific data, you're not really educating them. You're simply indoctrinating them. If a student learns a fact and it simply becomes a factoid and something a student can't challenge, you haven't really given them an education. All you've done is teach them how to regurgitate a fact. And so learning, you know, having the ability and learning the tools for critically evaluating everything that comes across the table is really important for science education and for education in general. So I really encourage having students think critically about all scientific data.
So you would certainly not limit this to evolution necessarily. You think that critical analysis is just a good policy for science as a whole?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think helping students learn the tools for critically analyzing and giving them the freedom to challenge anything that comes across the table is very important for education. That's part of a real education.
Well, Dr. Rebecca Keller, that is very well said. Your words carry much weight, given that you are not just a scientist, but also an educator as well. And I think I want to remind our listeners that Dr. Rebecca Keller is the CEO of Gravitas Publications, which publishes the Real Science for Kids textbook series. The website is www.gravitaspublications.com. That's G-R-A-V-I-T-A-S publications.com. Go check it out, learn more about the textbooks that she's writing, and we'll have a whole podcast coming up on this issue real soon where you can learn more about the Real Science for Kids textbook series. So Dr. Keller, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you for having me.
This is Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast, signing off. Thanks for listening.
Music on ID of the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Momchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowder. And the producer is Keith Minnick. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.